You are listening to the Dharma Ocean podcast. A distinctive feature of Vajrayana Buddhism is the view that emotions are intelligent expressions of energy that can lead us to the awakened state. In today's episode, we continue our exploration of the role of emotions in meditation practice and how they can guide us home to our basic nature. This talk was given at the 2006 Advanced Meditating with the Body Retreat in Crestone, Colorado.
The process of the shutting down occurs in several stages. Initially, as I said, there is this experience of there's awareness, but there's no me. There's no self-conscious sense of self actually in us. Moment by moment by moment. And the more we do the body work, the more we actually open that gap in the pond, and we become more aware of that process. And out of that, we start to see, actually we go through these stages. The first stage is empty space. And the thing about empty space is there's a paradox, because the empty space of our own mind at the same time has some kind of intensity within it. When we talk about emptiness, we're emphasizing the part that there's no conceptual thinking going on, so we say emptiness. But actually, it's not empty, because what's going on there is some kind of intensity, and the intensity has a certain... You see, it doesn't really have any qualities you can talk about, but it has the potential to go in certain directions. That's all we can really say. There is an intensity in the basic space of mind. And I think the way we know it is that when we start to exit from that basic space, we find ourselves exiting in different directions. For example, we may experience the basic space, you know, when we kind of pull back from it, as terrifying, as warm and comforting. And each one of us will have all these experiences. It's not like one person experiences it one way and somebody else another. We experience that basic space, like in the body work, there might be a glimpse. And then, okay, it's terrifying, or it's very comforting, or I'm feeling very attracted, or it makes me feel tremendously sad that I'm losing it. It makes me sad that I can't find it. It can make us angry. You know, I'm so angry that I don't exist. Paranoid. I feel so paranoid. So we can tell, because as we make that first initial retraction from the space, which is what we do as human beings, at least during this part of the path, that initial retraction comes out in certain different ways, and we can see that there's some real fundamental energy in there that at the time we're resting, it's beyond, there's no sense of any kind of identification and recognition. But as we begin to pull out, it really does have a certain shape to it. And the space is talking to us in a certain way. It's telling us, you should be afraid of me, or you should long for me, or you should feel terrible regret that you're losing me, you know, whatever it is that we go through. And of course, most people don't see, they don't even know that the space is ever there. They're going so fast. So understand what I'm talking about is something that becomes clear the more you practice. You start to realize what's actually happening in that moment when you pull back. So the first thing is simply retracting from the space itself, because it's so vast. Because we are so habituated to being small that being that big is, we can't stay there. We retract. So the first thing is just that there's something that we're pulling back from that is huge. And again, when you're in it, there's no sense of huge or small. There's no sense of peace or, you know, chaos. There's no act. See, the only way you can know anything is by identifying it and labeling it in some way. And labeling can occur on a very, very subtle level. In other words, just simply to begin to sense the space as an other is already a kind of labeling. Even though there's no mental activity involved in any kind of obvious way, the mere fact that we're pulling back and setting the space off against us is already identifying an other, even though this other so far has no qualities or characteristics that we can actually figure out. But then we pull back a little further, because we have this experience of space that is unnamed, and that's not good enough. You know, we still feel very insecure. So the next thing we do is we begin to see in the space our relationship to it. And so then we have fear, longing, remorse, regret, guilt. You know, sometimes when we separate from the space, we can actually feel enormous guilt. When I was two, I used to come down. My parents lived, I don't know where they lived, because I was too young to really know, but I slept upstairs, and I would sometimes come downstairs after I'd gone to sleep, and I would wake up in the night, and I had this experience of my mind being limitless, which for a two-year-old, I mean, a two-year-old is basically trying to get it together. And this was a disturbing experience, because I'm trying to, like, have an ego, and this other thing is happening that is going in a completely different direction. And I would come downstairs, and I would say to my parents, I didn't do it. And they go, well, what didn't you do? I didn't do it. I'm not guilty. It's not my fault. And what I think, and this went on for about a year, my parents were like, what the, you know? I mean, what is? At that time, they didn't give children medication, luckily. I mean, now you have two-year-olds who are actually put on medication. But so my parents said, you know, he seems okay. I mean, this normal kind of crazy, wild two-year-old. I mean, it's probably all right. It's just some kind of weird two-year-old thing. But I actually felt this terrible, terrible guilt. And what I think it was that I was separating from the space, that I knew about this space from my last life, and I was pulling back and trying to be me, and I felt a terrible sense of guilt. So guilt is another, I mean, strangely enough, you know, guilt can come up, you know, in that kind of context. Paranoia, anger, you know, whatever. So that's the sort of next stage. And then the next stage is that we pull back even further and we begin to separate out, and we begin to, you know, because if we're just left with sadness or guilt or whatever, that's still a very undefined experience. So we need to make that a little bit more concrete. So we'll begin to, you know, try to somehow develop a continuity maybe of mood in us. So then we go, okay, well, I feel very sad, so this sadness is who I am. So then you have a very subtle level of feeling developing that, you know, is a kind of habitual response. And then let's say that we're a person who doesn't like feeling sad because of the way we live. You know, sadness is actually very threatening for us. At that point, the sadness can actually turn over into something much more dramatic, such as anger. You know, many people who have a lot of anger discover actually underneath the anger is sadness. And the important point here, and, you know, this is something you read about in therapy, so this is not some kind of unusual discovery. I mean, for the person themselves, it's, you know, it's very, very powerful. It's very good. But the thing you have to realize, the sadness isn't actually about anything. And this is the important point, that the way in which we arise from the space of non-existence, which is what we mean by the space of mind, of the non-existence of our self-image, has much more to do with the energy of the basic nature than with anything that's going on in our world or any past experience. And this is where therapy actually gets very confused. Because when people feel angry, well, I've got to see what I'm sad about. Now I have to find out why I'm sad. And it's almost like every level of discovery, you have to attach a whole big storyline to it. And this is what happens in therapy. It gets very complicated. You know, the thing is, it's endless. I've met people who have been in psychoanalysis 3 times a week for 30 years. I actually know 2 or 3 people who have done that. There is no end. It never ends. All you're doing is refining the storyline of why you feel sad. But the thing is, there is no reason why you're feeling sad. The sadness is simply a response to a more underlying sense of separation, which has happened because under that, you know, we have retreated from the basic nature of mind itself. And as we've been saying the last few days, that underlying sadness is just the nature of the human person in a state of separation. There's no reason for it. I mean, you could say that's a reason, but there's nothing in our particular history that's the cause of it. It's simply being a human being. And it's quite interesting because people can get so wrapped up in trying to, they want to resolve the sadness. They want to resolve the sense of separation, and they may think, well, it's because I'm not doing a good enough job in work. It's because I'm overweight. It's because I'm no good at relationships. It's because my mother didn't love me. You know, I mean, if we went through the room with all of us and came up with why we think we have a problem, it would be everybody would have a different thing. But why is it that everybody thinks they have a problem? You have, how many people on the planet now? 7 billion? Is that right? Does anyone know? Let's say there's 7 billion people, and there are 7 billion people who think they have a problem. And you will not find one single person in that 7 billion who doesn't think they have a problem. You may find people who say they don't have a problem, but they are really fucked up. And, you know, it's just a matter of time until they snap. And they will snap. And usually those kind of people, when they die, is when you really find out what's been going on all the time. Well, it's not that people are fucked up at all. It's simply because the sense of separation is the fundamental sense that things aren't as they need to be, because we're living in a slightly artificial state as human beings. And again, we arise out of that basic nature in different ways. Now, you could say, Why does one person become, you know, we all separate. Now, why does one person experience that separation in a way that is felt as a tremendous loss? In other words, there's a tremendous sense of passion. Another person feels, at the most basic level of mind, some kind of fear. You know, why do different people begin to emerge from that state of non-self in different ways? It's because of the energy of the state of non-self. And you see, that energy is different for every person, and ultimately that's what gives rise to the very many different manifestations of neurosis that we all have. Everybody, you know, even though psychology, including Buddhism, they all have these typologies of the way in which different people are neurotic, nevertheless, everybody's individual in their neurotic style. Okay, fine. But what happens when you make the journey? Well, as we've talked about here, when you make the journey, you begin to realize that actually your enlightened style is even more individual than your neurotic style. How is that possible? Because in the mystery of the universe, the way in which we arise out of the basic space of mind, there's some kind of difference in the very beginning arisal. And Buddhas are different. You know, Amitabha, the Buddha of compassion, is red, and Akshobhya is dark blue. I mean, even the Buddhas themselves, the celestial Buddhas, manifest differences. And I'm sure every Buddha actually is a different color. I'm sure everything is different. So there's something in this basic energy of mind itself that is very, very individual. And the way we know is because the more we, both how we emerge out of it and then we merge back into it, our manifestation is different. Yeah, so we get to sadness or whatever, separation, fear, and then we, you know, that emotion itself is actually not, or that feeling, I would say, I wouldn't call it an emotion, a very subtle feeling itself. It has a color, but it doesn't have very much definition. It has a little bit. And then the next stage is that we start to have more complex emotions about it. So then we get angry. We get really, really scared. We become terrified. We become so hungry, you know, wild with, you know, yearning and hunger. We become very proud, whatever it may be. And but you see, here's the thing. We've still got a problem, because the emotions are still boundless. They're so close to the nature itself that they're boundless. And we really don't have much of a reference point there. So what do we have to do? We have to start attaching some kind of logic or storyline to the whole situation. So then we have a justification for why I'm feeling so hungry. It's because I didn't get enough love from my mother, or my caregiver didn't give me enough love, and therefore I feel hungry, and therefore I have to try to resolve this hunger and resolve my trauma. Or I'm very, very angry, but I have to come up with some logic, because anger is, you know, is, as we were saying yesterday, all of us, it's a very wild state. It's not domesticated. Or paranoia or whatever, we have to have reasons and logic. You know, the paranoia one is something that I find very interesting, because when you're on retreat, paranoia comes up, and it comes up at night very often. People get really, really paranoid, and they really think, I mean, did you think they were coming to get you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So the thing is, the paranoia hits you, and when I'm on retreat, you know, I have times when the paranoia is just, you know, it's infinite. And the thing is, because the emotion itself is so destabilizing and so terrifying, you do have to actually attach a storyline. So your thing was, the monsters are coming, right?
Yeah, the monsters are someone in a big truck.
Yeah.
There's something out there coming.
Something out there coming, yeah. As I've told you, you know, when I was on retreat a couple of years ago, my thing was, there were some fundamentalists who lived down in the valley. And I actually, at a certain point, I went through this. It's amazing how smart the mind is. The minister was actually talking about how we're all devil worshippers. So this was the logic I was using. And then there was some more logic. And then basically they were marching up the mountain. And I saw them coming. They were coming after me. And they were going to come up and kill me. So having been through various versions of this exact experience probably 20 or 30 times in retreat, of course, there was a little part of me that's going, do you really believe this? And there was another part going, yes, I do. I'm saying this to Robert because he's going to retreat. So I'm giving him some, you know, little retreat advice here. But, you know, we attach a storyline to it, and the storyline at least gives us a sense that we're sort of hooking this into me and my life and where I live and who I am and what my history is. And then, of course, we work other people into it too. You know, I was able to work in the fundamentalists who were, you know, had said these very bad things about us and so on. So at that point, we were beginning to feel a little bit more like we have a reference point. In other words, we've actually moved beyond the emotion itself. We've exited from the emotion, in the sense of creating a stable and familiar sense of self. Now, we may be, still, to all appearances, very paranoid, very angry, very hungry, but at the same time, we ourselves feel like we've got control. You know, we have asserted our sense of self. So, this is kind of how it works. You see, any state of mind that is beneath the storyline, so we have the storyline, we have the complex emotion, we have the feeling under that, and then we have the separation, you know, the level of how we separate from the basic nature. Everything except for the storyline is a problem because it's too vast. It's not tiny enough, and we don't feel like we're in control. So this is why the emotions are so important on the path. Because the strong emotions, and I would include also, you know, of course I'm speaking in a very, I would say, a very crude way, because these levels are much more refined and there are many more, but all the emotions from a very strong upheaval of some kind to ongoing anxiety, a subliminal sense of dis-ease, I mean, these are all actually emotions. These are all very, very important because they represent points where the basic nature actually is breaking through our storyline. Do you see what I'm saying? And you can say that the emotions themselves are egotistical, but actually they're not. They only become egotistical when we start attaching a storyline to them as a way of exiting. The basic raw feeling of emotion itself, there's no ego in there. There is a certain demeanor and structure, but that's not ego. There is a certain manifestation, but that's not ego. Any of the emotions, let's take anger, because we talked about that yesterday. the burning, fiery, intense experience of anger, in and of itself, before we exit into blaming ourselves or blaming another person, which is, you know, those are obviously the two things that we do, or sometimes you blame reality. Like if you're on retreat, I mean, these goddamn mosquitoes last summer, I'm telling you. Every time I went out to take a shit, there were 5,000 mosquitoes waiting for me. I go up into the mountains, right? You can see 100 miles. Sounds good, right? I was trapped in this 10 by 8 cabin with all my stuff for 6 weeks, and I could not leave the cabin ever without being attacked. You know, the river is down below, so I have to go pump my water. So every day, it was 100 degrees, I had to put on this hat with, like, I had to put on gloves. I had to put elastic bands around my ankles because if one of them got in, these are what I call high altitude mosquitoes. And they are big. And they're hungry. So it was very, very intensely claustrophobic kind of situation. So how did I start talking about this? Yeah, exactly. Getting angry, reality. So what are you going to get mad at there? You can't exactly blame yourself, and you can't. There's nobody around to blame, so who are you going to blame? I was just so pissed, but there was no one to be pissed at. It was a very strange experience. And the mosquitoes down, they really would hang around down the river because, you know, that's where they breed, and that's... And constantly, all day long, there'd be these huge clouds of mosquitoes, you know, coming up past the cabin. And for some reason, they were going east. I don't know why. It reminded me of squadrons, you know, flying over Nazi Germany, coming from England. I mean, why they would come up. And huge, literally probably 10 or 15,000 of them would come up in these squadrons and fly by the cabin. You can't blame them. I mean, they're just doing what they do. They're being mosquitoes. How can you blame them? And yet I was so pissed. I was so pissed. So we can get mad at ourselves. We can get mad at others. And we can also just get mad. And just we're kind of hanging out there because, you know, we're looking around, but there's nothing to really blame. But that process, you know, of exiting, that's where the ego comes into play. Because prior to that, there is no solid sense of self in the emotions. And that's why they're so powerful. I think the reason that people often regard the emotions as a bad thing, I mean, isn't that true in our culture, the emotions are bad? And even spiritual people who are working on themselves and maybe have a lot of depth of understanding look at the emotions and it's turned off. You know, these are bad and I don't want to feel this and in my practice I want to get away from them. It's not because the emotions themselves are bad, but actually because they're good. Because they do represent something breaking through the storyline. The storyline can't be maintained in the purity of emotion. You know, just as I said, in the purity of the natural state, there is no sense of self and we withdraw from that. The emotions are actually an expression of the natural state when they arise in their own pure form. And you see, each moment that we're exiting, it's not working. The only time it actually starts to work is when we get up to the storyline. So the emotions themselves, they represent the chaos that obliterates the ego. And that's why people don't like them. It's not because there's anything wrong with them. It's because they're actually from a dharmic point of view because they are such a powerful gateway. Now, the thing about emotions is that in relationships also they do the same thing. When we get too solid in relationships, the emotions arise and they just blow everybody's trip. Nobody likes it because the emotions actually blow everything wide open. So from a dharmic point of view, in the Vajrayana especially, there's a sense of tremendous respect for the emotions, the pure emotions. The emotions as they are before we exit, before we attribute a rationale, before we find an object to want or to hate. You know, the emotion in its pure state is utterly sacred. And it's actually the message of the awakened state. Do you remember what I was saying the other day, how the source itself loves us and longs for us and wants to lead us back, and how the source itself arises in different ways to call us home? Remember when I was saying that? And I was saying it in reference to the appearance of deities and protectors as one way in which the source manifests itself. Well, another more common way in the Western world in which the source is coming to call us home is the emotions. This is their call. And it's not just a call. It is actually their activity in creating space in our mind, in blowing our trip, in blowing our ego structure, even if just for a moment. Now, normally people react to the emotions the way they react, I mean, to any of the other manifestations of the basic nature. They react by pulling back and trying to identify, solidify, and set within a framework. That's the normal way. But the way in the Dharma and the way in which we're working here is that we, when we have any kind of strong emotion, we actually seek to remain within the emotion itself and not exit. And if we do exit, we come back to the emotion. When I first started teaching Dharma in a very open way, we had this group called the Dharma Village. That was the original sort of name. I won't go into details, but something happened one night which made me so angry that I couldn't teach. And that has only happened probably twice in my life. I was so angry I could not teach. Or let's put it this way, I could have taught, but I wouldn't. I was so pissed. And so I left. I just walked out, and 100 people upstairs, and I just left. And I went over to Naropa and went to their shrine room, and I sat down, and I realized I have two choices here. One is I'm going to kill somebody, or the other one is I can actually follow the instruction, which I had been practicing in retreat for a few years, so it didn't come up. I could follow the instruction that when you are burning with rage, you just look into the heart of anger and you don't worry about the storyline. Now, in my case, the storyline was so bad, in other words, I'm going to kill somebody, that I actually was, you know what I'm saying, the storyline was so bizarre and so completely out of control that I was encouraged not to go in that direction. And, you know, some modification of killing somebody would have been to get on the telephone and try to mobilize some kind of retaliation or whatever. But for some reason, I went to Naropa and I sat down. And I also felt very, very bad about walking out of my students. And that's, since that time, it's never happened. I'm going to have to be dead before I ever do it again because I felt so bad. Anyway, I sat down at Naropa with all these feelings. And I just looked into the center of them, and what I found was this brilliant, bright light, and so powerful it was unbearable. But it was not in reference to anything else. It was just what it was. And I realized that the very heart of anger is actually this brilliant, burning, incandescent intensity that actually isn't about anything else. And that burning incandescence was actually the nature. In other words, it was the vastness of mind, but it was the vastness of mind that was appearing in this brilliant, brilliant intensity which had been set off by these events. So it's interesting. These events triggered this particular, you could say, manifestation of the basic nature. This is how the basic nature works. I mean, if we want to think, step back a minute and look at it, that when something happens in the world, intense suffering or confusion or whatever, the source comes looking for us. And this is the way the source came looking for me, was here is this tremendous intensity. Now, you see, the normal thing for all of us, including me, would have been to start creating a storyline around this, separating myself from this energy and creating a whole big storyline about these evil people. But for various reasons, circumstances, whatever, maybe that was, I mean, it was a tremendous teaching for me, so powerful, and I wasn't in retreat. I mean, this is a very interesting point, that sometimes the deepest lessons don't happen at all when you're doing anything, you're just living. But somehow that window was open, and I realized this is actually the basic nature of emotion. It is liberated. It is liberated and is liberating, because it liberated me from all of the chaos and all the storylines and everything that was going on around, I was free. It wasn't that I wasn't aware of them. In fact, they continued to be fuel to make me even more burning, more incandescent, more intense, more brilliant, more, and because it was so intense, the only way to be with it was to be in it. The minute you tried to stand on the outside and look at it, you couldn't bear it, and you had to start thinking, I'm going to get these people, you know? So that's the intensity of the emotions, and that is why they are so incredibly powerful. But at the same time, for ordinary people, they produce tremendous amount of suffering and karma, don't they? Including ourselves. When we have very, very strong experiences of emotions, it usually ends up going in the opposite direction. In other words, it leads us to do a lot of things and take a lot of actions that, including maybe killing ourselves, that are actually not helpful, not beneficial, and create more suffering and more confusion. This is why in the Vajrayana we have this very interesting phrase, that which is poison for ordinary people is liberating for the meditator. And that's exactly what it's talking about. Very strong emotions are poison for ordinary people because it makes things worse. Whereas for the meditator, they actually are the means of liberation. And they are a means of liberation not only for ourselves, but as I was saying, in relationships, if we understand them properly, in other kinds of, interactions with people, in communities, if a community can live in this way, the arising of strong emotion can be liberating. And I do feel in this group, over the last couple of days, there has been a very, very strong expressions of emotion in this room. And somehow they have liberated us. They have led us to deeper understanding and more awareness and more compassion. So I think we have actually experienced a liberating quality when, socially unacceptable emotions and, as we've been saying, pretty much all emotions are unacceptable socially. Any kind of intensity is unacceptable, especially in this culture. When those are treated with respect and with insight, they become liberating. They actually liberate us. They free us. That's a kind of gives you a sense of an overview of where the emotions fit into the whole process and why they're so important for the practitioner. And the reason I'm mentioning this in this context, you might say, we're working with the body. Why are we talking this way? Because when you work with the body, you're working with emotions, and everybody has felt that. The body, over time, begins to put us in touch with, even if it's just our numbness, we become very clear how numb we are. I mean, if you're really numb, you don't know you're numb. Isn't that true?
Yes.
But when you start to realize, I'm really numb, that's actually very clear. That's not numb. Anxiety, impatience, these are all things that we become aware of in the body, where we become aware that the body has a very rich feeling life that is going on all the time. And therefore, we need to understand how to relate to that feeling life, whether it is sort of an ongoing emotional vibration that's happening in us all the way up to when we actually have outbursts and emotional upheavals. And, honestly, when you work with the body, you really do begin to open up. And I don't know if you have noticed this. We haven't really talked about it. It's sort of the unmentionable thing. But when you do a lot of work with the body, you may find yourself actually having more neurotic upheavals than you did before. Now, a neurotic upheaval isn't a neurotic upheaval. This is what I'm trying to say. It's actually the basic nature breaking through. And then what we do is we add on the storyline, and then it becomes really, very painful and confusing and so on. But that's okay. I mean, that's, the important point is that something's breaking through. And then we consider that neurotic because it makes us crazy. It makes us, like the ego thing becomes so clear, we're trying to get some ground. But let me tell you this, normally what we do is really crazy. That we go along with our habitual patterns and putting everything together and figuring everything out, and we don't see how crazy it is. But when the emotions come through, they show us how crazy it is. So the craziness we feel when we're having a neurotic upheaval is very small in comparison to the actual everyday insanity that is us, of us maintaining ourselves. So as usual in the Dharma, things are not quite what they seem. And we make a lot of interesting discoveries, and we find out that a lot of the things that we thought were bad are actually helpful, and a lot of the times when we thought things are going well, we're actually in really bad shape.
Download more of Reggie's teachings, find out about upcoming retreats, and to explore a variety of audio listening guides to assist you on your spiritual journey, please visit dharmaocean.org. Music is by Jeff Beal and Nawang Ketchog from the album Tibet, Cry of the Snow Lion.